And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The media is on fire with the release of the National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, that reports that Al-Qaeda is continuing to plan attacks on U.S. soil, focusing on prominent political, economic, and infrastructure targets with the goal of producing mass casualties, visually dramatic destruction, significant economic aftershocks, and fear among the U.S. population. The group is proficient with conventional small arms and improvised explosive devices. Today, I'm going to alert you to an equally dangerous cell of terrorists, willfully accomplishing the same ends, operating in our communities, and carrying out their sinister destruction of our homelands, our people, and our way of life, and yet somehow managing to conduct their business while our leaders go on with business as usual. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's good to be back after some time off. It's amazing how a few weeks can make such a big difference these days. Public opinion changes dramatically from week to week. And when it comes to environmental issues, the nature of the news is changing just as fast as any other sector. For example, I'm now being bombarded with stories of massive investments in solar and wind. Carbon cap and trade is now a given. Global warming is now a certifiable threat. Energy independence, which a few years ago was ignored, now finds its way into discussions of all sorts. It's pretty much business as usual, except I've come across a story that isn't getting enough play. Now, the National Intelligence Estimate warns us that Al-Qaeda is regrouping in the U.S. and focusing their attention on hitting us again. We all know that if we wake up one morning and hear that the terrorists have crafted bombs from ammonium nitrate, resulting in a series of massive explosions that have devastated our homeland, that people have been hurt and killed, that our environment has sustained irreparable damage, and that Americans are living in fear of further and ongoing attacks on our way of life, we would be outraged. Well, in part two of today's show, I'm going to shock and awe you with the news that these attacks are planned for tomorrow, targeting a whole region of America, that these terrorists are well-financed, have massive weapons of mass destruction, which they not only are planning to use on us, but have already used to destroy American communities. We're heading down to Sylvester, West Virginia, and we'll be talking with a victim of their relentless attacks on her and her community. She knows who they are, where they operate from, and amazingly, cannot get the U.S. government to do much about it. As a matter of fact, the current government is not only sanctioning these attacks on American citizens, it's clearing the way to have these terrorist attacks continue unabated. As an American citizen, as a patriot, I call on you to come to the aid of our fellow Americans who are suffering a terror unrivaled in the history of this nation. This is no joke. If we don't act against the new eco-terrorists, the wanton destruction of our American way of life, and the literal lives of our citizenry and our homeland will take place. This is a call to action to save the homeland and all that it stands for. Coming up, we talk with Pauline Canterbury and her call for help. But first, the Weekly Earth Summit.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and as the summer peaks, we're glad to hear from most of our regular conference participants. Dr. Mark Beckoff has spent a lifetime studying the amazing intricacies of animal behavior. He recently journeyed to Tasmania and shares his thoughts as he has just returned. Dr. Beckoff.
Next week I'm supposed to go to a meeting in Oxford, England on social cognition. And what's really exciting to me about this meeting is that they're bringing in ethologists, psychologists, anthropologists, and neurobiologists. And the neurobiologists or neuroscientists who they're bringing in, it's real exciting because they're doing this non-invasive work using MRI and PET scans. And so what I'm excited about, I'm going to talk about animal behavior, I'll talk about animal emotions, and this idea I have that, you know, animals know right from wrong. And what's so exciting about it is that I will get some feedback from them in terms of the different possible ways to study the neural mechanisms of, say, moral behavior and emotion. So I'm used to doing a lot of multidisciplinary, you know, interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary work. So I'm excited about that. And the reason is because in some of the books I've written and some of the meetings I've gone to and given talks, I have really been promoting that point of view. And I know that at some point people working on animals are going to definitely have to learn how to use the non-invasive techniques, not only from, you know, the ethical point of view, but I think when animals are stressed, it really compromises the data. And so I think it's a combination of ethics and really this drive to collect the most reliable data that we can.
Thanks, Dr. Beckoff. Our next guest brings an entirely fresh perspective on her observations of the various lifestyles of worms. Emma?
One day I was walking back to my dorm from gym class. I was still in my sweaty clothes and looking forward to a nice warm shower before lunch. While I had been in class, it had started raining heavily, the torrent hinted at by the steady sound on the metal roof. When class was dismissed and we all headed towards the glass entry of the Loose Center, it was evident that we weren't going to make it anywhere with any semblance of dryness. So I did what any other mature, prudent college student would do. I took off my tennis shoes, stuffed them into my backpack, and ran out into the rain, making sure to land heavily in the large puddle that had formed at the base of the steps leading to the building. At first, I capered down the path, splashing and generally enjoying the world that God had given us. But I soon became aware that God didn't put us here alone. There are a surprising number of worms on any college campus. Just like us, those worms have a sense of self-preservation. Just like us, they would rather die after a nice, long life surrounded by their grandchildren after a successful career in whatever it is that worms do, than be stepped on. But, unlike much of the human race, they are rather low to the ground. Rain is a lose-lose situation for worms. Either they stay in the drenched soil and drown, or they can squirm onto the pavement and risk getting stepped on by some unwitting college student who has to get to class on time. It's not as if we plan to step on worms. It just happens. I am willing to bet all the pocket money that this poor college student has that you have stepped on at least one worm sometime in your life. Okay, so either way, you don't get any money, but you get the idea. When I was heading back to my dorm that day, though, I didn't want to step on any worms. It would have been gross in bare feet. So I was more careful. And it's the same thing with the environment at large. It's not that we want to be harmful to the ecosystem. It just happens. But if we are connected to the real world, if we take off our shoes in a metaphorical sense and really take time to be in nature, look at wildlife, or spend time in the backyard garden, we have more of a passion for not hurting it. We'll have true zeal for the world that we live in, not where the rubber meets the road, but where the bare feet hit the pavement.
Thanks, Emma. That's Emma Sleeth, who talks to us every other week from the perspective of someone who's working her way through college. She's got the summer off. Lucky her. Now, sometimes we can be a little too careful, afraid to act until we are absolutely sure it's the right thing to do. Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who obviously acts from his head and his heart, and who is awakening the faith-based community with talks about his recent book, Serve God, Save the Planet, gives us some advice on the importance of action. Matthew?
I want to discuss something that comes up almost every time I speak. It came up last night when I spoke in Lexington, Kentucky. Someone asked, should I wait and replace my lights with compact fluorescents when the old ones burn out? And is there a danger from the mercury in the new compact fluorescent bulbs? To answer the first question, replace all your bulbs now, period. The resources to manufacture the new bulbs pale in comparison to the energy they save. Don't wait. Don't put it off. This is the one impulse buy I recommend. I recently spent a few days with someone who works full-time promoting electrical efficiency. He only had three efficient bulbs in his home. But with my prodding, we dashed off to the local hardware store, then came home and replaced the remaining 20 bulbs in his home. The second question is about mercury. Each compact fluorescent bulb contains 4 milligrams of mercury. To get that into perspective, an older style thermostat has 3,000 milligrams of mercury, which is the equivalent of 750 compact fluorescent bulbs. Because of the efficiency of the new efficient bulbs, we keep 2.5 times the weight of mercury that they contain from being exhausted into the atmosphere and water back at the power plant. Further, many areas currently take the compact fluorescent bulbs and recover their mercury once the bulb comes to the end of its long life. The moral of the story, don't be a victim of analysis paralysis. Change the bulbs today and give them away for holidays, gifts, weddings, and birthdays.
Thanks, Dr. Sleeth. Dr. Robin Moore has a big job working with Conservation International to focus world attention on the dramatic decline of amphibians around the world. He, too, poses some serious questions about the efficacy of science upon which the challenges of the future of amphibians is being charted as we speak. Dr. Moore.
In the latest volume of the journal Biological Conservation, Gardner et al. Present an interesting and thought-provoking paper entitled Paradox, Presumption, and Pitfalls in Conservation Biology, The Importance of Habitat Change for Amphibians and Reptiles. The authors question the shift in research attention away from impacts of structural habitat change and towards the cause of more enigmatic declines, reminding us that habitat loss remains the biggest threat, however. Indeed, 9 out of 10 threatened amphibian species are impacted by habitat loss. They explain that a frequent justification for this shift in attention is that we already have a good understanding of the ecological mechanisms that underlie the effects of habitat change. The authors test this assumption by conducting an analysis of 112 studies focusing on habitat change and its impact on reptiles and or amphibians. What they report is a number of geographical and thematic study biases. For example, most studies are confined to North America and most focus on amphibians. They conclude that serious deficiencies exist in our understanding of the effects of habitat change, and more research needs to be focused in this area. But who is really responsible for addressing these biases? It strikes me that there will always be bias in the literature for a number of reasons. First, resources and scientists are not evenly distributed around the world. Data will always be biased towards developed countries where the scientists reside. Second, competition for research grants means that novel and interesting studies on topical issues such as emerging diseases or climate change are more likely to gain funding than studies looking at the effects of habitat loss. Thirdly, publishing is not easy. There's pressure for scientists to publish, and there's a bias in the manuscripts that are accepted for publication. I wonder how many scientists secretly hope to find statistically significant results so that it will be a paper worthy of publication. No significant differences may be equally or even more important, but nobody wants to read about a study that found no difference between the study groups. So who is really responsible for biases in the literature? I don't blame the scientists, as long as the direction that research takes is dictated by the likelihood of funding and producing publishable results. The scientists will have to bend to accommodate such pressures.
Dr. Robin Moore just got back from a European conference, and he'll be talking about that next week. It seems as if the scientists are traveling the earth to communicate and share their efforts. Dr. Charles Kennell also recently returned from an international conference that is exploring global models that may serve to address global change. He ends with some inspiring, hopeful words. Dr. Charles Kennell.
On Monday, I attended a meeting of the Executive Summit at the 17th annual meeting of the International Council on System Engineering. And you'd ask yourself, why is an earth scientist talking to system engineers? Well, about 3 years ago, they invited me to a meeting in Toulouse, and I gave to them a talk on all the challenges that you'd have to meet to build a global earth-observing system of systems that would then provide enough global information for people to make strong decisions on sustainability issues, agriculture, climate change, water availability, and so on. And the basic message was, you're looking for a big system to engineer? How about the Earth? That's about as big as they get. So the very interesting thing is a bunch of hard-nosed system engineers decided that this was a project that they would follow. And so they got themselves, this international council got itself affiliated to the Global Earth Observing Group, which is a UN-administered group with the Secretariat in Geneva at the World Meteorological Organization. And this is a group that manages the agreements between countries on Earth observing. So now they are going to have another meeting in Utrecht next year in 2008, and they're going to focus it all on environmental measurement systems and all the system challenges involved in instrumenting the Earth. The big change is that the action is beginning to move from scientists, whose job it has been to diagnose all the complexity of our environmental challenges, to engineers who are going to try first to engineer a system that will give us total and complete awareness of all the complex interactions taking place between humans and the environment on the Earth, and ultimately how to engineer the system that will make that information useful and put it into the hands of the people who need it. So we're seeing a change in emphasis. In medicine, it would be the change from the diagnosis to the prescription. And then the next thing will be the administration of the medicine and the therapy, and hopefully at the end of the day, there'll be a cure. And so practical people, engineers, and other people now are getting very interested in the challenges of sustainability, and they're actually beginning to see places where their skills can make a real difference.
Thank you, Dr. Kennell. There's a lot of good news about how the world is waking up to the importance of maintaining our living systems. But in an unusual, ironic twist of fate, it is also driving what may be the worst eco-terrorist threat ever to our homeland. In just a minute, we'll bring you a real call to action to save our way of life. Stay tuned.